I think we need a lot of solutions for this because it's hard to have real growth without energy growth. And we do live on a finite planet, and we do have, some finite resources. And I think it's going to take a lot of ingenuity to bring a lot of new energy online over time.
Welcome to Wealtheon. I'm Wealtheon founder Adam Taggart. Thanks for joining us for part two of our interview with macro analyst Lynn Alden. If you haven't yet watched part one of this discussion with Lynn, in which she explains why she sees much of the world in economic deceleration heading into stagflation, head over to our channel at youtube.com/Wealtheon and watch it there first. It sets the context for the investment themes we discuss in this video. And we also tell you how to watch bonus footage of Lynn explaining the origin story of how she transitioned from avionics engineer to one of the internet's most respected macro analysts. So be sure to stick around to the end of this video to watch that. Okay, let's get started watching part two of our interview with Lynn Alden. Yeah, I guess my question is, I don't see a lot of fear in the average consumer's eyes about recession right now. In fact, we still are sort of seeing the opposite with this great resignation, where people are still being very choosy about whether they want to go back to work or what type of job they want to take. You know, my concern is that, you know, I could make an argument that in a year's time, we're going to go from a jobs glut to a jobs drought. And all of a sudden, you know, people are going to be, it's going to be the great unretirement movement. Right, people are going to be begging for their old jobs back. Those jobs might not even exist if the companies have laid off. So I guess my question is how for people that are entertaining the idea of a recession could arrive, from your just best guess, you know, is it going to be a light one and don't worry too much about it, or is it one that people actually should be taking precautionary action now for? I mean, could it be relatively prolonged? Could it be relatively deep?
I think people should take it seriously. I think that, you know, these things are crystal balls, right? We're trying to predict this, you know, severity of a recession. I think is inherently hard. And I'm not going to sit here in like an armchair and say, you know, this is going to be the third worst recession in X number of years and something that specific.
Yeah.
But basically,
nobody knows.
We look at the combination of there's really not a lot of new energy capex coming online. And supply chains might be eventually improving somewhat as China opens, but I think the energy side is still problematic. And so we have real world constraints about abundance, basically our ability to have more goods and services cheaply. And then on the other side of that, you know, unemployment is one of the most lagging indicators. So all of the leading stuff happens first. We've already seen now nearly a year now of deceleration in terms of all those leading things. And we're just starting to see it show up in unemployment numbers, but from a very low base, right? So unemployment looks pretty good. And we're starting to see that slowly get a little worse, but from a pretty strong position. And so I think that as we look out, you know, we'll see tighter financial conditions, unprofitable companies will have trouble raising equity, right? So they're in trouble growing and hiring more people. Very indebted companies will have trouble raising debt, and they might have to lay people off and slow down operations. And so I think that, and then that spirals when you start to get layoffs, you get weaker consumer demand, and then you get poor company performance that can result in more layoffs. And so I think that things that are discretionary in particular face squeezing here, right? So their costs are going up while consumer demand is also weakening. And so I think that that can continue spiraling into a recession. And how deep or prolonged it gets then depends on what are policymakers doing, what is happening with geopolitics, right? Is there a ceasefire and maybe, you know, we're kind of, you know, getting some of the gum out of the system, or is that just getting worse, right? There's all sorts of variables that are hard to predict 6 months, 12 months, 2 years in advance. And so that's why you can have a long-term outlook. Like I will say that I think inflation is going to be hot for the better part of this decade. That's a very long-term outlook, but that's still subject to kind of a quarter-by-quarter analysis of what's happening in rate of change terms and kind of monitoring that thesis over time. And so it's not like saying, you know, 2 years from now, this is the exact type of recession we're going to be in, or, you know, things like that.
Yeah. All right. So look, given the fact that I'm asking you to sort of prognosticate here, I really appreciate you doing your best there. I want to underscore one point you made here about the underinvestment in CapEx in the commodity space, because that's an exacerbating factor to what's going on here. So, you know, I've heard you say looking forward, you know, part of how we fare is going to be how much development do we put into this space. But we have starved this space in many areas for a decade or more. You know, talking to Rick Rule, he has basically said, hey, you know, if we just kind of keep things as is based upon the underinvestment that we have done over the past decade plus, we're going to have some severe shortages in the not too distant future and some key commodities. And he was saying that before the whole dust up with Russia and whatnot. The commodity CapEx right now is less than 1% of GDP. It traditionally is usually above 3%. And a quick stat here, since 2014, commodity CapEx has sunk 57%, while US GDP is up 34%. So, you know, I look at that and just think, yeah, that's just, if that doesn't change, that's just a mathematical destiny for sort of chronic shortages, keeping the input costs of essential inputs high. I'm assuming that's a part of your thesis for kind of high inflation over the next decade.
Yeah, when you filter out most of the noise, that's the main signal, is that we're not bringing a lot of new supply online for natural resources, especially energy, but also more broadly downstream of that, other natural resources. And to some extent, that's how history goes. We have these kind of roughly 15-year commodity cycles. You mentioned Rick Rule. He has that good quote that, all, you know, bull markets are all the authors of bear markets and bear markets are the authors of bull markets, mm-hmm. where, you know, during periods of high prices, that encourages a lot of new producers to come in. Investors want to give them capital, and then they produce a lot of new supply. They eventually overproduce, and there's some sort of demand destruction that occurs. Then you have this supply glut. And so, or, you know, prices collapse, and then nobody wants to put money into the space, and eventually demand keeps creeping up, and we work out that excess supply, and we get higher prices, and the cycle starts anew. So commodities, because you don't control the price of your own product, are inherently kind of a boom bust industry. And it's historically operated on roughly these kind of 15-year cycles. And so we had this period of oversupply, especially in oil. Basically, we tapped into new energy sources. We, a combination of cheap credit, the willingness by investors to you know, keep funding companies that were drilling while being free cash flow negative in shale. And so we flooded the market with oil, despite it not being particularly profitable to do so. There's kind of an endless you know, willingness to destroy capital for the sake of growth. But eventually that ended up not being truly endless. Eventually investors got tired of that. And then you also added ESG concerns, things like that. And then some large pools of capital are under the impression that you know, we're not going to need those resources in 5 years, which I think is way off.
Misguided.
Yeah. And so I think that it's a normal commodity cycle, but then it's amplified by a few things, including how much debt is in the system. Like I mentioned before. And so going through the next commodity bull market with this much debt in the system is inherently going to be inflationary, right? So basically, they have policymakers are going to have trouble reining in demand, and producers are going to have trouble ramping up new production. I think it's going to take time. And right now, the market still is looking at this as somewhat transitory. They're still pricing oil futures out 3-4 years, way lower than current prices. I think until the market wakes up and sees that, you know, sure, you know, the latest wars are adding to this problem, but if they see that the underlying problem is deeper than that, the underlying problem right. is lack of investment, it wakes up and starts pricing future oils way higher and encourages a ton of new production to come online wherever they can. You know, I think this is going to be a problem for a while. And it's I think we need a lot of solutions for this, because it's hard to have real growth without energy growth. And we, you know, we do live in a finite planet, and we do have, you know, some finite resources. And I think it's going to take a lot of ingenuity to bring a lot of new energy online over time.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the awareness of that is still relatively low amongst the investor base. That's my personal assessment, could be wrong. All right. So this is a good segue into the conclusion of the discussion here. And also, I want to thank you for being willing to let me ask you the bonus question that we'll do at the end here. So let's, at the end of the day, it's investors that are watching this program and trying to figure out how to position and whatnot. So if we can kind of conclude on your general outlook for the markets, I think you just made a really good long-term case for exposure to hard assets. But if I can kind of wrap up what I've heard from you to date, it sounds like you think that the Fed's going to try to tighten for the near term, and don't underestimate, them and their ability to do that, at least until something breaks. And therefore, the probability of lower financial asset prices ahead in the short term, probably not bad. You got to be ready to pivot if and when the Fed does pivot. But don't let me put words in your mouth. I mean, how would you be sort of encouraging people to consider navigating this current interim period that we're in?
So for the most part, I focus on being somewhat diversified, where I want good equities, I want good real estate, I want commodity exposure, hard monies, and then some cash for rebalancing and volatility management. And I will tilt that in different directions based on some macro factors. And so starting in December of last year, when it became clear that the central banks were going to, do a round of pushback against inflation, that they were waking up to the fact that it was not transitory, I warned my clients about becoming more defensive, wanted to have, decent amounts of cash, focusing on defensive value like pipelines and healthcare stocks, things like that. And the recent update I've added is that I also add a little bit of longer duration treasury bonds, which is unusual for me. I, as someone with generally more inflationary outlook, I've generally avoided that space this whole cycle. I added a small amount of those as a hedge, basically to defend against the possibility of a continued economic slowdown, yield curve inversion, that sort of thing. But the bulk of my portfolio remains focused on high quality, long-term assets. So oil producers, energy pipelines, other commodity producers, just hard monies like gold, silver, Bitcoin, and just things that produce cash flow, things that are that have utility, and very cautious around things that are not profitable, and very cautious around things that would face margin pressure in a stagflationary environment.
Okay, great answer. In some ways, I'll say cash is king. So what I hear you saying, which is either cash itself right now or things that have positive cash flows, profitability, those will fare better in the type of environment that we're in right now. Okay, two quick questions because you mentioned them. One, the precious metals, they've had kind of a funky year. On the plus side, they are one of the few assets that has held their own, right? I think gold is still up for the year versus the general market indices, which are down pretty substantially. And the cryptos as well, down pretty hard. But I think a lot of people are scratching their heads and saying, God, I would have thought it would have done so much better than it's done. And it did briefly touch an all-time high back in March, but it's drifted down since, and it's kind of been languishing since then. Any particular opinion on gold right now?
I would have expected it to probably be over 2,000. So it is a little bit lower than I would have guessed by this point. During economic growth periods, so rising PMI environments, let's call them, generally investors prefer to be in other assets like equities or, riskier assets. And gold tends to do well compared to other risk assets in declining PMI environments, which is what we're in now. So as you point out, it's held up better than most equities have year to date, for example. And it's also held up better than long duration bonds, which have sold off pretty sharply. And so I think it's starting to do its job here in 2022. As a defensive store of value. And I think that there's probably going to be a sovereign bid in the years ahead because I think that there is an increasing realization among sovereigns that holding the bulk of their reserves in another country's liabilities comes with more counterparty risk than they thought. And so I think that we're going to see basically probably a greater share of gold exposure in sovereigns. But I think right now the market's rather diluted, right? So for example, people can invest in gold, they can invest in silver, they can invest in Bitcoin, they can go into like all these other cryptos that they went into. And I think that a lot of that has to be cleared out, right? So I think that there are a handful of things that are good money. I would classify gold, silver, and Bitcoin in that. But I think the long tail, these other things that a lot of retail investors poured money into, are malinvestments. And so I think that as that kind of melts away, investors go back to what actually has value. And I think that over the next 5 years, I think gold is pretty well positioned to take advantage of a stagflation environment where, stocks aren't going straight up, and margin pressure is being felt by a lot of these companies, and that sovereigns are kind of realigning their portfolios a little bit more towards diversification and real assets.
Okay. All right. Yeah. And being flat for this year, flat's the new up in a market like this, right? So I shouldn't paint it as a disappointment. It's actually, as you said, store of value. That's exactly the role it's playing right now. And for a long time, the precious metals holders have been dreaming of the day where, the average investor balance sheet says, you know what, I'm actually just going to move a percentage or two from these riskier assets now into gold, for diversification, or because they're not performing as well and gold's hanging in there. And it doesn't require a lot of money, a lot of capital moving into this space for gold and silver prices to move pretty big, because they're relatively small markets compared to the stock market or to the bond market. And I see you nodding while I'm saying this, so I won't beat this horse too dead. Okay, real quick, Bitcoin. I noticed that when you sort of refer to the crypto space, you're really saying Bitcoin and you're not saying, cryptoverse at large. I don't want to put a lot of words in your mouth. And again, another big topic. I don't want to shortchange you here, because I'm sure you've got way more nuances that you'd like to express. But sort of in the wrap up here, what's your general perception of Bitcoin? And it sounds like you still hold it in your portfolio. So you've got some belief there.
So I'm structurally bullish on Bitcoin as a part of our portfolio. I think it has a good 5+ year runway ahead of it in terms of increased adoption. The reason I like it is because it's really, when you look at it, it's one of the only truly decentralized cryptocurrencies, meaning that there's no central entity that can make more Bitcoins or change how the code functions. It's highly distributed. It even makes multiple sacrifices in terms of other capabilities in order to remain basically as hard as, and as immutable and as decentralized as possible. And in the wake of that, you had thousands of other projects come along. Most of them are not as decentralized as they claim to be. I've written a number of times. I've been pretty critical on Ethereum. I've been pretty critical on some of these other projects. And I think that not every single project out there is bad, but I think that there's a very it's kind of like unregulated penny stocks, basically, except that some of them are worth tens of billions of dollars or more. And so I think that for the most part, I am not bullish on crypto, but I've been bullish on Bitcoin, and I've been bullish on stablecoins as a technology, and specifically the fiat collateralized ones, not the algorithmic ones. And so, for example, that whole Terra Luna fiasco is one of the things I wrote about ahead of time and warned people about, because that, again, was in the bucket of just unsustainable things, malinvestments out there. And so I think that Bitcoin, as basically peer-to-peer encryption money, is a useful tool that people have now. And I think the market's going through the process of testing it, monetizing it. We're 13 years into that. It still has risks ahead of it. But I think if it gets past those risks, I think it'll continue to be a good investment. So I'm pretty bullish on that. But it's not something that, I think you want to have more exposure than your volatility tolerance or your level of research into that space.
Okay, great. I'm glad you mentioned the stable coins, because I had a ton of questions around that. It sounds like they haven't really sort of shaken your fundamental case for stable coins, because you're less into the algorithmic ones, which are the ones that have gotten in trouble for the most so far, right?
Yeah, I think so. Basically, what fiat collateralized stablecoins do is they make the peer-to-peer side tradable, while the custodian's still centralized. And there's two main use cases for them. One is that on these offshore crypto exchanges, people use them as a unit of account for trading. But I think the more interesting use case is that in emerging markets and frontier markets and other countries that are having currency problems, if you try to hold dollars, in a Lebanese bank or an Argentine bank, they can easily be confiscated from you. They can be converted to the local currency and then taken from you. And of course, it's risky to just hold dollars under your mattress. And it's also hard to get. And so stable coins are interesting because, people in developing countries have a way to get dollar exposure in a way where, even though it's centralized because the custodian is centralized, the custodian is outside of that country's jurisdiction. And so if you're an Argentine investor, you know, having some stable coins can be a useful part of a portfolio, and it's a way to deal with you know, currency problems. That's obviously less volatile than Bitcoin. Now, there are risks around the collateral, and there, you know, there's two main ones. There's Tether, and there's also USDC. USDC's you know, 100% cash and T-bills. Tether uses a portfolio model, and so investors can choose which one they want to have exposure to. And so it's one of those things where I think that technology has legs to it, but of course there is regulatory risk. I think over time they're going to be pressured to be more and more in that, you know, entirely T-bill model, entirely cash model. And I also think it's, you know, large countries could go after them and make them basically be operated like banks. And so I think we're going to see regulations tighten around them. But that it's pretty obvious why people in developing countries tend to use them. And I think the trap that people fall into is to realize that just because something claims to be a stable coin does not make it a stable coin.
Right.
And so algorithmic stable coins have had a long history of failure. And the problem with this whole Terra Luna one is that they were giving people artificial high yields, 20% yields that were funded by VCs that were clearly artificial to draw people in. And then it blows up. They're like, well, it was an experiment. You know, it's just experimental technology. Well, you were drawing people in to an experiment with 20% artificial yields. So that's more than just an experiment. And so basically what they were trying to do was operate like an emerging market central bank, but without capital controls and without the ability to tax a real economy. And so algorithmic stablecoins are kind of inherently a volatile and dangerous area.
All right. Well, I really appreciate that context. I will have to have you back on at some point to give you a lot more room to run to talk about the nuances involved in both Bitcoin stablecoins and what else about the blockchain ecosystem that you'll like. Sorry to make you cram this into the very end here, but that was a great, concise answer. All right. Well, look, right before I ask you where people can go to find out more about you and your work, Lynn, you know, we talked about you just gave a great sort of litany of the assets that you think could fare well given the current environment that we're in. Are there any other sort of general bits of advice that you would offer people given the type of future that you see coming here? For example, I'll make another plug for it here, but I've written a guide called the Guide to Layoffs, the Layoff Survival Guide, which you can get at wealthion.com/layoffs. So if you haven't gotten that already, folks, go get it. It's free. But just trying to give folks, you know, some tips of things that they could do today that should their job become at greater risk tomorrow, they're going to be a little bit less vulnerable, a little bit better prepared based upon steps they've taken today. You know, whether someone's a homeowner or whatever, are there any just sort of general bits of advice that you counsel people to start at least, you know, thinking about right now, given the fact that a recession may be in the cards here?
Well, I've been a proponent of minimalism, right? So basically not being bogged down by consumerism, right? And that, of course, can mean different things to different people, but basically focusing on what's important in life. You know, focusing on what actually makes you happy versus keeping up with your neighbors or things like that. And so I do think this is an environment where you want to have, you know, your income diversified or as steady as you can get it, your expenses well contained. At least your kind of ongoing mandatory expenses rather contained, so that you're flexible to deal with hits to your income. And I think, you know, it's good. One way I described it is that supply chains are optimized for low inventory and just-in-time delivery, and so it's kind of up to the households in order to have a buffer. And so that doesn't mean you have to have like a, you know, you don't have to be like a full prepper with like a bomb shelter. I think it means that it's good to have a stockpile of things that you need on a regular basis, whether it be food, whether it be paper products and things like that, but certain medicines. I think it's useful for consumers to have a buffer of supplies for things going forward, especially in challenging economic environments.
Great, very well said. I like all of those. Diversified incomes, contained expenses, sort of your minimalism, like just focus on the fewer things that bring you joy and don't worry about, you know, the trappings of everything else, but also the buffer. And obviously, you know, from a job standpoint, having a 3 month or even a 6 month, you know, kind of stash of savings just to keep you going in case you lose your job, but also, as Lynn said, just key essentials, right? And you don't have to go out and buy them all tomorrow. You can buy them incrementally over time so that you're doing it within your household budget. But all that stuff makes just great sense. All right, so Lynn, for folks that have really enjoyed this conversation, would like to follow you in your work going forward, where should they go?
I'm at lynnalden.com. Mostly it's free material, free newsletter, public articles. I also have a low-cost research service. And I'm on Twitter at lynnaldencontact.
All right, great. And as somebody who is a regular consumer of Lynn's contact, it is some of the absolute best out there, folks. And a lot of it is free. So definitely avail yourself to the free stuff. And if you like what you see there, I can't recommend her premium service highly enough. All right, Lynn. Well, look, thanks so much for coming on. Folks, I'm going to ask Lynn her origin story in our bonus video. So to watch that, just go to wealthion.com/Lynn. That's L-Y-N. Lynn, thanks so much for giving us so much time. You've been a great soldier through this, especially just having come down with COVID. I can't tell you how much I appreciate that. Really look forward to having you back on the channel soon.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, now's the time when the program where we bring in the lead partners from New Harbor Financial, one of Wealthion's endorsed financial advisors, to do a little Monday morning quarterbacking to what Lynn just said, but also talk about what the markets are up to since last week. Mike, John, great to see you guys again. Mike, why don't we start with you? Got a number of questions here for you regarding what Lynn said, but what struck you as sort of most memorable from that conversation?
Yeah, thanks, Adam. A lot of talk about monetary policy and central banks still, of course. That is the only game in town. It remains the only game in town and probably will be for quite a while. Lynn pointed out a number of salient points, I think, just kind of looking through my notes. She said that for the last 30 or 40 years that we've under invested in real world systems. And so therefore we have a shortage of real things, you know, commodities, energy and whatnot. And so, you know, that's kind of the what we're facing today and what we're likely to face in the next 10 or 20 years. It's one of the reasons why we like commodities and real things. Not to mention that they're severely undervalued relative to financial assets, which are severely inflated. So the future probably should be a good place to invest in real assets, i.e. commodities. She also said that we're in a economic deceleration combined with stagflation. And, you know, she likes defensives. Again, real things. She even mentioned some healthcare in there too. But energy and other commodities make sense here. She also talked about the inflation problem, which has become a real issue, right? We had COVID and we printed something like $6 trillion of money and kind of threw it into the system and said, spend it, all while people weren't traveling or going out and that type of thing. And it's created real inflation problems. And now we have an issue. It's become a political issue. Inflation has. And she mentioned Paul Volcker, you know, certainly a hero of mine that tamed inflation in the 80s. And he came in and raised rates and broke the back of inflation. And she pointed out a very important point, that we don't have the same latitude as that anymore. There's so much more debt in the system. The total federal debt is something like $30 trillion. And it was, I'm guessing maybe $1 trillion back then, if that, probably less. And so Paul Volcker could come in and raise rates and break the back of inflation. If we were to raise rates significantly now, it would cause a depression with $30 trillion plus of debt on the balance sheet. So the Fed can't do that. The Fed can't do that. And so we're probably facing permanently higher inflation going forward. And that's another reason why it supports the idea of investing in real things. So I think I'll stop there. But, you know, the real point is that the Fed is in a box. We have inflation. They can really only jawbone and try to talk it down, because if they raised rates too much, it would cause an absolute depression slash crash. That could happen anyway. But it's going to be more of a tactical kind of a slow move versus what Paul Volcker did.
All right. Number of important points you mentioned there. John, I'm coming to you with a key question here regarding cash. So, you know, Lynn and I talked a lot about both the CapEx underinvestment in a lot of key commodity producing sectors that, irrespective of all the other issues going on right now, you know, we talked about Rick Rule, who said before the inflation problem and before the war in Ukraine, that if we just sort of kept things at status quo, we'd be entering critical shortages in certain key commodities in the next 5 years or so, just because of decisions that were made 5, 10, 15 years ago in terms of starving a lot of these sectors of CapEx, right? Then, of course, that gets exacerbated by the shortages that we're having right now, created by the war and other supply chain issues. So as Mike just said, you know, that's going to provide a tailwind on these commodities, these tangible assets going forward. We then also have all of the currency devaluation concerns on top of that, you know, with all the central bank balance sheet expansion, all the fiscal stimulus that's been done, et cetera. So it's kind of this, like, you know, double whammy against the purchasing power of, you know, paper, basically. And so as Mike is saying, hey, you know, we want to look to real things. I know that's a big part of your investment focus, guys. You know, it gets complicated, right? Because you would say, all right, well, then get out of everything paper and get immediately into hard assets. But, you know, we have this issue that Mike was talking about where the central bank is has many fewer options now than it did, say, back during the Volcker era. And so we're now going into this period of economic deceleration that Lynn mentioned. And, you know, the Fed is actively out there raising the cost of capital right now, trying to bring down demand, et cetera. So, you know, we very well may be going into a recession here, and that may bring down the prices of almost everything, including eventually, if the Fed is successful, demand for commodities, at least in the near term, the next, you know, couple of quarters, maybe next year plus. So where I'm going with this is, you know, we can look at those big macro trends and say, well, that's really bullish for tangible assets. But we got to be cognizant of what might, that's over the long term. But in the short term, and by short term, I mean next 6 months, next year or so, the forces may be really disinflationary slash maybe even eventually deflationary. And that's where cash comes in, right? Because if you're looking at that long-term arc, like I mentioned, well, you probably want to sell cash, you know, immediately and just buy hard assets. But, you know, you could lose a lot of value along the way if we have this, you know, massive deceleration, massive pull down of asset prices, et cetera. And so where I'm going with this is you really have to be cognizant of what's going on and nimble, and you may need to play strategies like cash in the short term to then be able to redeploy it when the time is right into these harder assets. And I know that's the role you guys play as financial analysts here. But I wanted to kind of raise this because this is something you guys have to think about all the time. Correct, John?
Absolutely, Adam. And there is quite a bit of nuance there. You know, from a classic textbook standpoint, cash is cash, and long-term bonds are some of the very worst places to be in a textbook inflation environment. But that's over a long period of time. You know, if we're thinking about, you know, the purchasing power degradation of cash over a 15, 20, 30 year period, certainly could be shorter than that, you know, 5 or 10 years. But point being is there are absolutely many examples in history where even with inflation, cash can be one of the very best places to be in the short term. You know, look at this year to date, for example. Most assets, aside from energy and some of the real goods that we talked about, are down pretty soundly on the year. Broadly, stocks are down. Broadly, bonds are down. Some areas of the stock market are down way more than others. Yet cash, and this is in a, you know, very headline-grabbing inflationary environment. And cash is, on a relative basis, preserve purchasing power over this short period of time much better than most other assets. And if we go, for example, to the 1970s, which is, you know, similar in some ways to right now, with stocks being overvalued and inflation, you know, being a problematic thing that the central bank hasn't been able to get under control yet. And I found it interesting that Lynn pointed out that, you know, Volcker didn't just come in with this novel idea of you know, taming inflation. His predecessors, two predecessors before him, had that same agenda, and they just couldn't get it under control. So point being, if you look at the 1970s, stocks got hammered in the early 70s because they were at very, very rich valuations. going into an inflationary environment. And, you know, look at today's news, you know, Target, for example, the retailer Target, just twice in the last, or three times, two times in the last 3 weeks, they've lowered earnings guidance and have said they have to raise prices due to inflation. And it's getting hammered, right? So that's just like just one example of, so when inflation starts to take hold, rich valuations and stocks, broadly speaking, are some of the very first things to go. And broadly speaking, stocks, when they're at reasonable valuations, can be a very good long-term inflation hedge. But the key is they've got to be at, you know, valuations that are not obscenely overvalued like they are right now. So the cash, in a very long-winded way, represents a really important ballast in a portfolio, we think, right now, that can be converted to other things when they are priced more favorably to become that better inflation hedge than stocks, for example, today broadly are able to be right now.
Yeah, all right, good, thanks. Yeah, you know, I asked this because I still see some headlines out there that say, you know, in inflation, cash is trash, et cetera. But you just gave a great, you know, explanation for why it can be really important, especially key elements in the timeline of a stagflationary collapse or correction. Lynn herself started off the interview talking about, you know, sort of a barbell type of allocation with sort of energy stocks on one end and then a lot of cash in U.S. treasuries on the others. And even your example there about Target, John, yes, high prices, high input prices is forcing them to raise their prices, which hurts, you know, the consumers coming in the door there. But also they said that they had excess inventory. And I think that's part of, it's part of the bullwhip effect where you just have a lot of inefficiencies when you're reacting to shortages. And we've talked about that in the past. But I also think that that is that Powell's efforts are beginning to bite. You know, you're beginning to see the beginning of demand destruction here. I think it's going to get a lot bigger, and time will tell. But, you know, we should expect more of this. And if that indeed happens, and you know, this is becoming a pattern, right? We saw Amazon, Walmart, and now Target basically say, we overstaffed, we overstocked. You know, that's kind of the classic signs you see sort of heading into a recession, because that's showing that, you know, consumer demand isn't showing up the way that these companies were planning on. All right, Mike, we'll come back to you here. So, you know, Lynn, I think, did a pretty good job of sort of explaining, okay, here's what I think we should be doing, given the macro conditions that we're heading into. She talked about diversification, which I'm glad she did, because I don't think we can mention that enough here. Very important part of just a good portfolio construction in any environment, but particularly in one like the one we're heading into here. Yeah, you know, we're having to place bets based upon, you know, how we best see things going on here, but not every bet's going to turn out right. So the diversification is hopefully going to really be your friend here. But she talked about owning good quality equities, those with good balance sheets, ideally good income streams, some real estate, some cash, and hard assets. And, you know, we talked about the fact that she's a big fan of a lot of commodity producers, but energy in particular. She likes not only, you know, the companies that are going out there and producing the commodity itself, but a lot of the infrastructure-based companies as well. One thing to note about oil itself, which I know Lynn is, you know, quite bullish on, is after interviewing her, Goldman just came out with a forecast saying that they see oil hitting $140 a barrel by this coming summer. Oil's at about $119, $120 right now. $140 a barrel, I mean, that's getting close to the all-time high of like $149 a barrel. And that was pretty hellacious when we hit that back, when was that? Like 12 years ago or so, 11 years ago? So to be back up there, that summer is definitely not going to be pleasant. So anyways, Mike, I'm curious to hear your reaction to Lynn's allocations. I think a lot of the spirit of it sounds similar to what you guys are doing at New Harbor, but what do you think?
Absolutely. A lot of the spirit is there for what we're doing. I mean, we wouldn't expect anyone's opinion to match exactly what we're doing, you know, because obviously nobody knows for sure what the future brings. But energy, she talks a lot about, and we like it too. I mean, I guess I would comment that energy seems to be getting a little bit extended. If you look at the ETF XLE, it's up around 91. Technically extended. Now, that doesn't mean it can't go higher, particularly if crude does hit 140 by the summer. But we really do like that sector long term. We would have hedges in place In fact, we do have an energy position with hedges in place, but we would be looking for opportunities to either buy more or add, you know, or buy it back if we end up selling it on dips in the market. She also talked about, she also talked about other things like resilience. She talked about paying down debt, simplifying your life, reducing expenses, even having some basic things like food, medicine, and other things like that. And, you know, she said not to be a doomsday prepper, which I don't think she is or any of us here are, but it certainly makes some sense to go into the cabinet and see if you know, check on your old stores of those types of things, or if you don't have them, to at least have a little bit, just in case shortages do arise. It's possible. Starting to notice some empty holes on the grocery shelves. It does seem like shortages are going to be more of a commonplace thing going forward. So just some basic preparation makes sense. In terms of investment strategy, I'm not sure she talked too much about gold and silver. I might have missed a little bit of that, but gold and silver are certainly at a very viable place here. I think we mentioned last week that gold's action has been almost boring recently at 1850 or 1860, but still on a weekly and monthly chart, the bullish breakout out of the triangle a few months back is still valid. It's almost a sleepy kind of sideways move. We would expect that to probably resolve upwards. So think about adding to or establishing a gold and silver position. Other than that, we agree. Having cash makes sense for what should be an ultimate or eventual opportunity as this market dips. On the S&P, which is down only about 13% year to date and 14% from its all-time high, it bounced sharply off that 3,800, 3,850 level. Really think the next move down is probably to the 3,500, 3,600 level if we take out this kind of recent support around the 4,000 level, which seems like a cement floor. But when that changes, I think we see a fast move down there, and that could be another short-term opportunity. But those are just some of the things that we're looking at right now.
All right, great. John, I'm coming to you for a second to kind of begin the wrap up here, but one thing you said there, Mike, I just want to dig into for a sec, which was that oil looked like it was potentially a little bit extended here. I'm a big long-term fan of energy. I think oil prices will probably be higher next decade than they were this past decade. But oil is one of those things that can move pretty radically, pretty quickly in price. And, you know, an example of that is 2 years ago, pretty much almost to the day here, oil was down below zero dollars a barrel, if you can imagine that. I mean, it just sounds crazy to have those words come out of my mouth. But there was a period not that long ago where you almost couldn't get rid of it. So where I'm going with this is just that there's a lot of potential things that could bring down the price of oil later this year. One is just the classic high prices are the cure for high prices. You know, if the Fed is successful in depressing economic demand, there's just going to be less economic demand for oil. Goldman's predicting this $140 a barrel at the height of summer driving season. Well, summer driving season is going to end, obviously, as the fall starts arriving. If there's progress on, you know, peace talks on the front of the Ukraine war, there's just a lot of things out there that could, you know, all of a sudden cause a lot of the capital currently rushing into the oil space to want to come out and grab profits or whatnot. And I'm not saying don't invest in it. And I know you guys, I believe, still have a, you know, position of your portfolio in it. I just want folks who are getting excited about it, you know, hearing Lynn and Goldman and whatnot talk about it, that if you're getting in now, that you're just aware that it's elevated and there could be a risk here of just, you know, some sort of natural pullback for any one of the various reasons I just mentioned. John, any reaction to that?
Yeah, Adam, absolutely. I mean, the trends that Lynn speaks to there about the chronic underinvestment, these are long-term trends that they're not going to be fixed very quickly. So they're long-term persistent pricing pressures, we believe is an accurate conclusion. But nothing in that says that in the short term, we can't get some wild swings. Your point of oil prices going negative because there simply wasn't enough places to store the excess oil back in the COVID meltdown in March of 2020 is a perfect example. You know, it was funny, as you started raising this topic, I was looking at a chart of oil from 2007 to 2009 with the current, you know, trend overlaid on top of that. And if you look back at that period of time, 07, 09, oil peaked at just under $150 a barrel. And within 6 months, it was below below $40 a barrel. It was almost an elevator drop. And of course, that was, you know, in no small part due to the implosion of the economy. But it's just perfect example of, you know, even though the structural shortages and underinvestment is still there, it doesn't mean the commodity itself can't swing wildly. And of course, the stocks related to that are going to swing somewhat in sympathy to that, but, you know, not nearly as wild. You know, lumber is another example. If you look at lumber, lumber's off, you know, pretty huge since March of this year. That's a real thing, and it's probably emblematic of some slowdown in the housing market that we haven't really seen come through the headlines yet. You know, we've seen some cooling off of mortgage demand, even though rates have pulled back a little bit in periods of time over the last several weeks. But yeah, the commodity prices can swing pretty dramatically, so you want to be very careful about them. And you know, so for example, we use hedges on some of our precious metals positions at the moment, just because we think it's a prudent thing to do. Position size and risk management is really important when you're thinking about direct exposure to commodities.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there's a bigger point to be made here too, which is, you know, those swings we were talking about in oil, when you were at the extreme before it reversed, either on the upside or the downside, it was almost unimaginable where it was going to go, right? And I just want to flag that for investors. We'll use it here for oil. You know, some folks might be thinking, gosh, with everything going on in the world, there's no way oil could go back down to $70 a barrel. It's unimaginable for folks right now. And I think all we're saying is, hey, these commodities have a history of doing the unimaginable. So just don't completely discount it. But I think at a higher level, the new era that we're entering in here, I think we're going to see a lot more of the unimaginable happen here. I think even both stocks and bonds being down as much as they are so far this year was unimaginable to many players in the marketplace in December, just back in December, right, when the market was at its last highs. Certainly, if you were in some of these tech darlings, you know, not the big Microsofts and Apples, but, you know, the Facebooks, the Netflixes, the Nvidias, the whatevers, you know, some of those stocks got walloped, you know, 40, 50, 60% or more this year. And I think that was unimaginable to those tech investors just back in December. So, you know, kind of where I'm going with this is, you know, I think we're entering into an environment for all the reasons that Lynn talked about, where there's going to be a lot of surprises in store for the average investor. And so, you know, the smart people are the ones who are going to be paying attention, remaining nimble, having some defense in place, having some cash in reserves that if prices do indeed go down to good, you know, fair valuations at some point, that they're A, not taking losses as much, and B, they've got some dry powder to deploy. I kind of see you guys nodding a little bit as I'm saying this, but I'll come back to you, Mike. Does this sound consistent with how you guys are looking at the future?
Absolutely. You know, you've got to be nimble, but more than anything, I think you've got to be defensive. You know, like I said earlier, simplify things, pay down debt, raise cash, have some basic necessities, have some gold and silver, and be ready for what comes. Nobody knows exactly the path of things. Sure, crude oil and the oil companies are very extended. Doesn't mean they can't go more vertical from here, but just based on our experience, we think it's better to be more cautious than to plow right in, for example, because we know eventually there'll be a reaction and we would rather increase the position or establish one if we didn't have one on some kind of reaction. You know, and in terms, just one point about diversification. You mentioned diversification earlier. Just make sure diversification doesn't mean that you buy, you know, all 500 stocks in the S&P, or, you know, you buy a fund that's in the, you know, total stock market. Diversification means diversification in cash and other assets. And I know that's what you meant. But just to make the point, because some people think, well, I'm diversified. I own an index fund. Well, we're living during a time where the indexes have never been more overvalued. They're more extremely overvalued by far than every previous example, including 1929.
Right. And sorry, but you're 100% exposed to equities.
Right?
Exactly.
You're not diversified across asset classes. You're all still in one asset class. Yeah.
Absolutely. So, and you know, hold cash, even though that most people don't like holding cash. Most investment managers don't like holding cash. Cash should be a good place to be, even though we're concerned about inflation. In the near term, I don't think that's an issue. And John, you know, explained some reasons why. So yes, diversify, but that also includes cash, land, gold, you know, other types of real things, and be patient. I'm surprised, you know, this market is not really very far off of its high, about what, 14% or so from the most extreme example, I think probably in world history, certainly in US history, of overvaluation. So here we're still at exceedingly high levels. And I would say be patient, let things unwind, and be very conservative.
All right, great. So one thing I want to sort of wrap up here on is what I really like about Lynn, and I know you guys are sort of birds of a similar feather, is Lynn got her start as an engineer. And folks, after I did the main interview with Lynn, I then recorded a bonus video with her, just having her explain sort of her backstory of her journey to becoming the, you know, macro analyst that she is now. And she got her roots as an engineer, as John and Mike, I know you guys did too as well. And in her case, she was focused initially in the avionics industry. And so, you know, why that's important is you have to be really dispassionate and just look at the entire system, how it's going to work. So that, I think, you know, that's great for a macro analyst, because you have this sort of systems-wide view of how everything interacts together. But you also have this safety element onto it that I hear you talking about here, Mike, you know, with getting defensive as you diversify. Because obviously in the avionics industry, your goal is to keep the plane in the air, right? You're trying to avoid a catastrophic crash and loss of human life. And I think that lends itself really well to a financial investor or financial advisor, because at the end of the day, what you're trying to do is protect people from a catastrophic crash of their wealth, right? So I'll tell folks how to go watch that video in just a second. But John, I sort of see you nodding and smiling a little bit, like, yeah, that's exactly kind of who we are. So I'll give you a chance to sort of get the last word in here.
Yeah, that is, Adam. You know, we do come at this with a rigor, I think, that only an engineer can be trained to do, or maybe not only, but engineers certainly are. But we entered this business not just because we love the science and the data part of it. We love connecting with people on a human level and educating and bridging that, you know, gap. You know, one thing we can say for sure is our industry, the financial industry, makes things infinitely more complex and confusing than it needs to. So many products and spin and blah, blah, blah. Our job is to hopefully sift through that and you know, get focused and help our clients focus on, you know, kind of the data and what it likely means for the bigger picture without all the kind of bells and whistles and glossy print and stuff like that. But interesting, the avionics thing, you know, I think of like instrument flight. You know, I'm not a pilot, my brother is. I know Mike's had some pilot training, but you know, instrument flight, when you're flying with instruments, they're so critical because your typical senses are going to tell you to do the wrong thing. They're going to tell you what is up is down and what is down is up. And that's why the instruments are really important. And that's a very fitting analogy to markets that become bubble-like or outright bubbles. The markets do their very best to try to get you to do what is wrong and convince you that it's right. It's just the psychology of bubbles. So what our antidote to that is, the only thing we know, because we're human too, is to look at the data and continually, you know, check the data. You know, never before in history have we seen valuations like this. And yes, you know, you can say, well, maybe this time is different, but that's every bubble is defined by that. So, you know, we hold a very high you know, instrument panel, if you will, to kind of deviate from what the data tells us.
All right. That's a great analogy too, about the instrumentation, where, you know, once you get up there and you're doing a couple barrel rolls and, you know, getting pressed down by several G's or whatever, I'm using a lot of Top Gun words here, but you know, your instincts get scrambled, right? And so you really have to rely on the instrumentation and the data. And that's sort of what I'm trying to underscore here, which is, there's a lot of, you know, I talked to a lot of different people in the investing space, and there's a fair amount there that are sort of, they invest according to a philosophy, which can be good in sort of setting a North Star, but a lot of these guys get stuck to the philosophy and they ignore the data, right? And I think that's when you can really get into trouble, right? You fall in love with a certain asset class, or, you know, as we've talked in the past, you get underwater in something and you just figure, I just got to hang in there until it gets back, and then I can reassess my options. And really, you know, all those things are when the human sort of primal wiring come in and really muck up the dispassionate analytical, you know, approach. And so anyways, you know, I just want to underscore, I think that what Lynn brings to the table and what you guys try to bring into practice in your firm there, on behalf of your clients, is really what the world needs more of. And obviously it's a big reason why I have you guys on this program every week to sort of share your thinking and keep everybody grounded. All right. So folks, if you'd be interested in watching that short video of Lynn providing her backstory, just go to wealthion.com/Lynn. I'll put a link to it below this video, but that's a great one to watch after you've watched this video. For those that don't know, you know, look, every week I talk about the importance of working with a professional financial advisor. I think we just gave you a whole bunch of reasons in this video for why that's a good thing if you haven't talked to one recently. If you've got a good one, great. Send them this video, have them listen to Lynn, and then just say, hey, how am I being positioned relative to the macro trends that Lynn talked about? If you don't have a good one to do that with, or you'd like a second opinion from one that is, you know, very comfortable and familiar with those trends, feel free to schedule a free consultation with John and Mike. You can do that over at wealthion.com by filling out the short form there. We actually give you the details right at the end of this video, so stick around for that. Last, if you enjoyed seeing Lynn on this program, would like to have her on again, and like to see other guests of her caliber, please do me a favor, support this channel by hitting the like button and then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. All right, John and Mike, thanks so much for joining me for yet another week. Folks, don't forget to go watch the bonus video with Lynn over at wealthion.com/Lynn. And John and Mike, whatever happens in the markets next from here, we'll be tracking it on this program together next week. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.
Had a great time. Thanks, Adam.
Thank you, Adam. We'll see you next week.
If you'd like to schedule a consultation with one of the financial advisors at New Harbor Financial, simply go to wealthion.com. These consultations are completely free and there are no strings attached. The good folks at New Harbor will simply answer any questions you have about your investment goals or your portfolio and give you their best advice given their latest market outlook. They're willing to do this because they care about protecting people's wealth, and because Wealthion has connected them with so many thoughtful investors just like you over the past decade. We started doing this because so many people have approached us in frustration, looking for a solution because they're feeling out of alignment or downright ridiculed by the standard financial advisors who have been managing their money. You know the type. The kind that just pushes all of your money into the market, scoffs at the idea of owning gold, and when you bring up concerns about the market's sky-high valuations, they say, "Don't worry. The market will always take care of you." For many of the reasons discussed in today's video, we think this is one of the most challenging and treacherous times in history for investing. We strongly believe that today's investors are best served working in partnership with a conscientious professional financial advisor who understands the risks in play. Now, we're agnostic which professional advisor you work with, as long as they're good. If you're already working with one, that's fantastic. Stick with them. But if you don't, or are having trouble finding one you respect or trust, then consider talking to John and Mike and the team at New Harbor. Now, for those about to ask, yes, there's a business relationship between Wealthion and New Harbor, which we've put in place to make sure everything is handled according to SEC regulations. All the details on this are clearly provided on the Wealthion.com website. Also, it's important to note that New Harbor is able to work with U.S. citizens, green card holders, and those with existing assets in the USA. But for regulatory reasons, they aren't able to take on non-US clients. All right, with all that said, if you'd like some insight and guidance on how to protect your wealth during this unprecedented time in the markets, go to wealthion.com to schedule your free consultation with the good folks at New Harbor. Thanks for watching.